to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today has a passion for wandering. Daniel Thomas is a native of Willows, California. He published his first book, Essays from the Ten, in 2005. His second book is called Evening Country, and he now has a third collection of essays, which he calls simply 100 Miles. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the title of that last book, that collection of essays called 100 Miles. Mm-hmm. What does that name come from?
Well, maybe it'd be easier for me just to read a paragraph from the introduction. In the mood to do some exploring, yet not wanting to travel a long way from home, I came upon the idea of limiting myself to destinations within a range of 100 air miles. Using my home as its center, I create a circle with a circumference of 314 miles and an area of 7,854 miles. As the circle formed, I was totally amazed at the diversity of landscape that I was about to enjoy. Going west, I would travel across the Sacramento Valley floor, over the Pacific Coast Range, to the California coast. I would view fields of rice, rows of vineyards, mountain forest, and crashing waves. Turning north, I could visit majestic Shasta Dam, see the craggy peaks of the Trinity Alps, or take a winding mountain road to the base of breathtaking Mount Shasta. Steering south, I could visit a refuge where a million geese and ducks winter, explore the delta where our two major rivers converge, or walk the streets of our state capital. And to the east, of course, are the Sierra Nevada, with plenty of fascinating stops along the way.
So that's where you got the title of this most recent book
Absolutely.
Of yours.
Mm-hmm.
The first book you wrote was called Essays from the Ten. And where did you get that name?
I think Essays from the Ten, the title, resulted in my love for a piece of property that my wife and I spent a considerable amount of time improving, creating an atmosphere where we felt a high degree of solitude and beauty and peace. And when I came to coming up with the title, it seemed a natural thing to say, well, these are essays from the 10.
The 10 meaning 10 acres.
The 10 acres.
Your 10 acres of
mm-hmm.
prosperity, mm-hmm. which then became the center of this 100 miles
Absolutely, yes.
that your most recent collection refers
mm-hmm.
to.
Mm-hmm.
So the center is this, and you live in Corning.
Corning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Born in Willows, but you live in Corning, and so this 100-mile radius. And you have written all these essays, and you also have your third book, Evening Country, and I think you have an essay in that collection,
in my second
Evening
book.
Country,
yeah.
mm-hmm. about life is an essay.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read that one for us?
Sure, sure, be happy to. My essays are founded on the deep-seated belief that there exists a certain unity to the human experience. The great essayist Montaigne said it more succinctly. Every man has within himself the entire human condition. In other words, when I'm talking about myself, I am in no small way talking about you. It is my fondest hope that through my sharing thoughts, ideas, memories, desires, complaints, and whimsies, which is how Philip Lopati defines the personal essay, I'd have been able to establish with you a lasting dialogue. My essays are personal, and to the degree I've been able to do so, are intended to create between us something beyond the formal grasp of a hand or polite salutation. It's called intimacy. No matter where I travel, whether it's to the heart of the property or some far exotic place, the compulsion to write about my experience remains strong. That's how I assign meaning to what I see, feel, think, or believe. It's my way of defining myself in relationship to the many things I may never understand. That's what makes the whole process so beautiful. Life's an essay waiting to be written. There's so much to see, so much to know, and more to do than any one lifetime can hope to fulfill. Yesterday has vanished, and today is coming on strong. Increasingly, I find it difficult to sleep too late in the morning, or sleep at all. Sleep is time's thief, It all depends upon one's attitude, does it not? Either morning is my God or my God is morning. The greatest thing about life today is that I exist at all. That's an attitude formed by the lessons of failure merged with the power of accomplishment. I call it the adversity factor. My life forces flow over the brim. On days when my energy wanes, I try to hold on to the truth. And on my best days, when I feel like Pollyanna, I don't apologize. Why should I? Life's an essay waiting to be written.
And you have written these essays that you feel we can all identify with, and particularly because you're writing about this part of the world that we all know to some degree or another. We may live in Northern mm-hmm. California, but really not know it the way you do, because you have wandered these hills and valleys.
I do suffer wanderitis, yes.
In fact, that's the name of the second essay in your most recent book, 100 Miles, is called Wanderitis. Tell us why you have this passion for wandering.
Again, perhaps I should just read it.
Sure, do that.
I'm called to wander by a force far beyond my understanding. What I do understand is that I'm afflicted with chronic wanderitis, an innate compulsion to see what's around the next turn. And that compulsion is essential to my life. Wandering is my passion. As much as I love where I live, I simply must satisfy my addiction to travel, whether it's around the block, a trip to the outer edge of my 100-mile circle, or at some risk beyond. Most of my travels are solitary ventures, although when I join by my wife, it's a pleasant extension of our wandering together through life. When traveling alone or not, our togetherness is a constant. I'm never really alone. Movement suits me. I enjoy sitting quietly on the 10, what I call the property where I live, absorbing the sights, sounds, and aromas. Yet, as satisfied as I am to be a part of this place, I find myself responding to a primitive restlessness. Wandering is as much a part of my being as food, shelter, affiliation, sex, and all the other pleasures associated with this sensate existence. Sex and all the other pleasures associated with a sensate existence. I like that. As settled as I am equally unsettled. A road not traveled calls to me, and I submit to that call. That's when I pull out the maps and begin to plot a course, which I consistently revise, because the destination is less important than the fact that I'm going somewhere. And somewhere is everywhere. Our emotions, spirituality, physical well-being, and functioning intellect thrive on our ability to shift from one place to another. But those same dimensions find comfort in the safety of consistency. The comfort provided by home and hearth is seductive. Pulling away often demands effort, determination, and a tolerance for change that is an essential aspect of life. Not only is it a powerful stimulant, clearing the mind of burdensome garbage, but it reminds me that no single day duplicates another, not one. It's also essential to my writing. I meander with a pen in hand. I travel as a writer. I write as a traveler. The marriage of those two elements of my life is a good one. The prospect of discovering a new place jumpstarts my neurons. Revisiting a place I've been before most always reveals a myriad of things I missed the first time. This interest in what lies beyond the next ridge, around the next turn, or is, as so often the case, no more than an arm's reach away, is something I seem to be born with. I grew up in the Sacramento Valley where the land is table flat for miles in every direction. But dramatically bordering this great valley are tawny rolling hills visible 10 miles to the west of my hometown, leaning against a higher range of oak-covered slopes, folded against steep brush, covered peaks which ultimately give way quickly to the timbered Pacific Coast Range. This is the view that beckoned me every day of my young life and formed the basis of my insatiable desire to know what adventure awaits me amidst those four distinctive elevated formations unfolding westward to the sea. Can you visualize that?
Oh, yes.
To this day, when I'm driving down a country road or wandering my own property, admiring the changing leaves, pausing to listen to the shrill of a red-shouldered hawk, or kneeling down to turn a rotting log, I contribute my interest in the natural world to those formative years when I'd gaze longingly at the blue mountains to the west, wondering if I'd ever have the opportunity to touch them. And while I waited, my curiosity festered, and my wanderitis, spawned by delayed gratification, was born.
So you say spawned by delayed gratification. Mm-hmm. What delayed you in being able
to? The lack of mobility.
So you grew up in Willows, mm-hmm. and then, but you didn't live there forever. So what delayed your writing? Because you've only recently put down or published your writing. So were you writing in those years or just?
I've always been a writer. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that always helped me when I was going to college and the university was that the writing tasks assigned were always the things I look forward to. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I always did fairly well. And along the way, there were people would often encourage me to say, Dan, why don't you publish that? But I had other roads to travel then. So.
So after college, you didn't move back to Willows. Where did you, as an adult, live?
Well, as an educator, I traveled. Mm-hmm. I was a teacher in Woodland. I was a teacher in Sebastopol, California. I worked as a counselor in Woodland. I was an assistant high school principal in Woodland. I was a principal of a junior high in Santa Rosa, a high school principal, Santa Rosa High School. Mm-hmm. I was a principal there.
And, so during these years, you say you're always a writer, but did you have time to write?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I did. I do a lot of writing just for the fun of it. I actually got involved in a poetry phase at one time, and an artist friend of mine took many of her paintings and put my poetry down at the base of the paintings, and we had a show.
Oh,
it was
nice.
A lot of fun.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, what is the process now? And you mentioned in your essay that you always have notepaper and something to write with that you carry around with you so that you can make notes. But what is the process then when you actually sit down to put these things on paper? You write outdoors under a tree or in an office?
All of those places.
Right
now, I'm enjoying this conversation so immensely. You're probably a part of another essay.
I thought you were going to say you were going to whip out your pen and paper.
No, sometimes I try not to do that. That's poor taste. But I suffer at various times something I call mind tides. And when those tides begin to flow, it seems that so many aspects of my life are absolutely dying to be written about. So when that happens, I can start an essay in my little redwood grove. I can start it at my little cabin at the end of the property. I can be thinking about it while I'm driving and stop and make some notes. But my formal writing takes place in my den. My computer and I have become good friends.
Well, this sounds like the opposite of writer's block.
Yeah.
You have certainly no block.
Not right now.
Such a tide, as you described it, that you have to put it down.
Yes. And when I do go to a period where I'm not writing as much, my wife very kindly says, you're just gestating. This is not a writer's block. You're gestating. And so I appreciate that kindness on her part.
In fact, recently, I think it was, I don't remember who said that, but a friend told him when he was a writer who said he had writer's block. He said, you're not good enough to have writer's block.
Ah, there you
and
go.
He said the very next day he got busy and started writing again.
Oh, well said.
Well, you in your essays, you describe these places that you visit here in Northern California. And we often, I think, some of us who live here don't really realize the opportunities for such joy that surround us. We're looking, we need to go to Hawaii. Let's mm-hmm. go to Maui. Mm-hmm. And when maybe just down the road is a mm-hmm. wonderful experience that I think your essays could help people enjoy more. In fact, there's one that you described. It was a very simple scene. You and your wife are sitting out, I don't know, in your yard somewhere. And you talk about what it smells like to be out in your yard. This is toward the end of your recent book. It's an essay called The Seductive Scent of Green on page 121.
The Seductive Scent of Green. Yes, yes. What page was that?
121. And your wife's name, by the way.
Marilyn.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a very short essay, and I wrote it in a sense following a conversation that my wife had. And sometimes when you're sitting with someone else that you care for, you're trying to capture that minute in so many different ways. So I was trying to capture a moment. It's called The Seductive Scent of Green. Of all the things my wife and I do to celebrate our happiness together, the one we do most consistently is sit amongst our fledgling forest of redwoods and poplars, weeping willow, liquid amber, and sycamore. We listen to the sound of splashing water flowing into our pond, peer into a sky illuminated by a trillion stars, and are seduced by the aroma of green. "Ah, sweetheart," my wife whispers, "don't you love the smells?" I pause before responding, my olfactory nerves on alert. She's right. The very air about us is simply delicious. I sniff some more, like a hound in search of prey. "My goodness," I exclaim, "you're right." And she was, because all I could smell was sweetness. It was a rich smell of grasses, evergreen, broadleaf trees, roses, rich soil from a newly turned garden, combined with the damp aroma of pond-fed tules and waterweeds. For the next hour, not a single car passed by. The highway to the north of us was silent. No dogs barked, no coyotes howled. Only the stars intruded. We said nothing. We heard the silence. We marveled at the stars. And were intoxicated by the seductive scent of green.
Isn't that wonderful?
I like that.
As much as I like looking out a window at beauty and greenery, there's that dimension of that wonderful aroma. And when you go up into the mountains and just take that deep breath. It's just...
Isn't it marvelous?
Oh, it is.
It's marvelous, yeah.
It's wonderful. It is. Now, there's another woman in your life, your mother, and in Evening Country, you write an essay about that. And so Marilyn has been your wife now for many years, but could you read that essay about your mother?
Yes, I'd be happy to.
And this is from Evening Country. I'm talking to Daniel Thomas, who is an essayist who lives here in Northern California. And most of his essays are about the countryside and nature and how much he enjoys taking walks or trips within 100 radius mile of his home in Corning. And he's written three books. The first one was Essays from the Ten, referring to the 10 acres that he lives on. And his second book is Evening Country. And I don't know if you remember the essay that you wrote about your mother. I thought it was from Evening Country. It might be from a different book. Do you remember,
Daniel? I'm scanning right now.
Well, that's okay. We can come back to that one because you have so many other essays that I would like to read for us. There's one that you talk about, the Corning Hills, on page 16 in 100 Miles. What happened there? You call this essay The Domes.
Well, when I first moved to our house in Corning, I was fascinated by the fact that there was a small range of hills just to the west of us. And so it didn't make sense to me. So I did a little small amount of research to determine that they actually were domes, the result of some fault action many years ago. So that's where I came up with the title.
Uh-huh.
Would you like me to read this one?
Yes, please.
I don't have to drive far from the 10 before encountering a surprising geological anomaly, a range of rolling hills that looks perfectly out of place here in a bed flat valley where olive orchards are the norm. In a bed flat valley, can you picture that? Where olive orchards are the norm. Yet, less than a mile west, just across the road from a 200-acre olive orchard that fronts my property, the terrain suddenly evolves into gentle hill country where cattle roam and the coyotes howl the night away. Geologists call these hills the Corning Domes, which, as a friend explained to me, are the result of uplift on the eastern edge of a fault called the Corning Fault, located along Interstate 5, extending north to Red Bluff. Over time, lots of time, the action of wind, rain, and water transformed the uplifted formations into what are now most commonly called the Corning Domes. I first discovered this hilly country some 14 years ago. My wife and I had just moved onto our property, and we were eager to explore our new neighborhood. One evening, we climbed into my pickup, and instead of taking the normal way to the interstate, we decided to take a farm road that angled to the interstate in a westerly direction. We hadn't driven much more than a mile when the paved road was replaced by a rough dirt road. It was early evening as we began to experience a dramatic change in the landscape. Within minutes of leaving home, we found ourselves driving on an unpaved road surrounded by rolling hills. It was early spring, and a large herd of cattle was moving across the grassy range, casting long shadows in the evening light. And for a moment, I felt as if I were driving through some remote place in eastern Colorado, looking west to the Rocky Mountains. We drove on, not once encountering another car, past more cattle, and turned away in disgust when we saw the rotting carcass of a coyote draped over a sagging field fence. Soon we came to a small rise in the Rhone from the road from which we could see a flowing river of white light. The interstate was near. I recently spoke with a friend, Keith, who was raised in Corney, about the hills. Hills? What hills? He asked. When I asked him if he was aware of them as a kid, he told me that his friends from town used to hunt rabbits there, but they never really thought of them as hills. Just small bumps, he explained, on what was otherwise an uninspiring landscape. Maybe the bumps have grown some since his childhood. After all, he's been living almost as long as I have. Maybe longer. The dirt road became a favorite shortcut to the interstate, except when winter rains would make the road impassable. It was also a favorite hangout for kids from town. I recall one evening returning home from a trip to Sacramento. It was dark when we turned off the interstate onto the cutoff, grateful that we were so close to home. Suddenly, we saw a dozen cars parked like scattered toys on both sides of the dirt road. Some had their headlights on. Most didn't. Seeing that the road was nearly blocked, and frankly, a bit anxious about what I was getting into, I slowed to a crawl. Several teenagers were leaning against their cars, and a small group was standing in the middle of the road. I stopped the car, rolled down the window as my wife gave me that, "Are you sure you want to do that?" look. As if I had a choice, one of the older kids came over to my pickup while others watched their huge hands gripping cans of beer. He didn't seem really menacing, but he sure seemed drunk. "Hey," I said in a calm voice, as calm as I could imagine I could manage, "party night, huh?" while steering cautiously through the gathering of teenage revelers. Several of them raised their cans in a mock toast as I pressed the gas pedal a little harder than necessary, and as they stepped aside, sped away. "So I guess we won't be driving this road at night again," I sighed. "No, I don't think we will," answered my wife, deciding to hold back any criticism she might have had on my handling of the situation. The road is paved now, and the pristine nature of that stretch of road has long been destroyed by a burgeoning gas field and several homes where none existed before. Starry nights have been replaced by invasive floodlights and the awful sound of gas wells putting away the silence. Traffic makes walking less safe, and leaking gas has displaced the aroma of sweet grass with a smell of noxious fumes. I miss the weekend revelers. Had I known then what I do now, I'd have joined their party.
Well, speaking of noxious fumes, you have one of your essays is to the turkey vulture, and that seems like kind of a maybe unpleasant subject for an essay, but I really enjoyed that essay on the turkey vulture.
Strange, isn't it? In the eye of the beholder, I suppose.
Yeah. In fact, you call that essay "The Ugly and the Beautiful."
Yes, yes.
Can you read that one for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. "They may have an ugly face, but once in flight, their beauty becomes self-evident. I'm talking about the turkey vulture, that often reviled scavenger with its bald red head and witch's beak, which, when in effortless flight, is simply magnificent. Blair Anthony Robertson, staff writer for the Sacramento Bee, described the turkey vulture in a recent article as perhaps the most significant flyer in all North America, with its six-foot, V-shaped wingspan and its genius for soaring. He goes on to describe how it can ride thermal air currents for hours at a time without ever flapping its wings. Forget that ugly head and check out those wings. It's no wonder that they are sometimes mistaken for eagles as they soar 1,000 feet above the landscape, scouring for their meal of choice, carrion. On rare occasions, vultures will take live prey, but their talons are too weak to make them effective killers. Besides, their large size and lack of speed can make it easy for potential prey to flee. But their hooked beak is perfect for reaching into carcasses of dead animals and tearing flesh. That's why roadkill is their specialty. And it's that propensity for picking at some poor animal flattened by a speeding car that earns them a mixed reputation. That, and their habit of regurgitating sometimes on your car window when panic into abrupt separation from their meal. It's almost comical to watch as the turkey vulture takes a two-legged running hop and flaps furiously to get airborne. What's not so comical is when, in an effort to lighten their load, they vomit huge amounts of utterly vile, sticky, undigested carrion. And this is what they feed to their young? As difficult as it might seem to love these birds, their importance as effective scavengers clearly makes up for their absence of beauty. We see them often along the roadside cleaning up roadkill, near lakes and rivers, feasting on discarded fish, and on the tin, doing what nature intended them to do, devouring the dead. For several days, a half a dozen vultures have been dining on one of my fallen sheep. In fact, it was the specter of turkey vultures gliding over my pasture that alerted me to the fact that one of my feral sheep had gone down. Practically all that's left now is a pile of wool and some scattered bones. On the other hand, there's the carcass of a dead dog lying on the dry creek bed under the bridge where someone tossed it a few days ago. The other morning, I noticed five or six vultures perched on a limb overlooking the creek bed. I walked down to the bridge this morning to check out the vultures' progress. The dog was still there, virtually untouched. I've since learned that turkey vultures prefer the meat of herbivores and tend to avoid dogs and other carnivores. Now, I wonder how they feel about omnivores.
Well, this is an essay, and there is more to this essay, but I think that people will enjoy these images that you present of this turkey vulture. I've been talking to Daniel Thomas. He has written three books. His most recent one that he was just reading from is 100 Miles. That was an essay on the turkey vulture and its value to us that we might not have appreciated. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a distinct pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.